Easy. So, in fact, as Tony said, I was supposed to present first result from the LHC in 2009, and I tried my best, but external forces were stronger than I were. Nevertheless, I think I have enough material to present. Now, overall, I divided the lecture in two big parts. Basically, according a little bit to the title which I was given. So the first part will mostly concentrate on detectors or the experimental aspects, and the second part will then mostly focus on the early physics. Now, when you have to give such a lecture or a talk about LHC detectors, you have to make some choices. First of all, you have only 3 hours, and you have to decide, do you stay rather superficial, or do you want to go into some details at some places? If you want to go into some details in some places, probably you cannot cover everything. So I had to make a choice regarding the detectors, and I'm afraid I might disappoint a few of you. Then you have to make the choice, either you just describe how the detectors look like. So Atlas has this, 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 and this. CMS has this, 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 and this, and so on. I decided not to do it like this, first of all, because I would get bored very much myself, and probably because you all know it already. And part of the detectors, I guess that you actually know the details better than I do, at least for some part of the detectors, as I also could see on the posters. So I decided to do something a little bit different. I decided to step maybe a little bit back and try to give you the bigger picture. Namely, try to explain a little bit why the detectors today look like as they look like, or the other way around. If you would have to build a detector today, what would you have to do? Or how would you approach the problem? And you will see that there are a lot of questions to be answered before you actually have detector on paper. So that's why I will start first to discuss what are the ingredients for taking a decision on designing a certain detector. And once we have all the ingredients, we can look in more detail at the actual implementations. And here I had to make the choice that I only concentrate on, let's say, the general purpose detectors, or let's say the high PT scattering physics of LHC. So I concentrate on ATLAS and CMS, and I will not be talking about LHCb and ALICE. I'm sorry for that. But I think I would have not been able to cover all what I want to cover. Now, another disclaimer I have to put here, you might notice during these hours that there might be a slight bias towards CMS on my slides. This is only for practical reasons, since I am in CMS. So it's easier for me to get some information than ATLAS, but there's no other deep reason behind that, officially. And I should also mention that I got a lot of material from other colleagues from similar lectures or papers. And actually, I want to point out that a very useful resource is this paper here by Daniel Fradvon and Paris Svikas, where they summarize basically, in fact, how one arrived at the design of ATLAS and CMS, what are the main parameters, and so on. And I use quite a lot of material from this paper, so it's a very useful information, source of information. Now, this is what I call our future playground. You're going to play a lot. You know almost everything now about the machine itself. I will concentrate on the two general purpose detectors, ATLAS and CMS. And you have seen there are, for example, posters on physics done by the LHCb experiment, and also on physics done by the ALICE experiment. So let me start, and let's try to go into the problem of what is actually measured, why, and how we're going to measure certain things. And as you will see, and you always have to keep in mind that indeed proton-proton collisions are very complex, which makes the life more difficult than, for example, you had it at lab times. So if you look at the collisions, there is one part basically which you have covered now in this school in the first part of the week. You should by now know how you actually compute inelastic scattering between protons. The question now will move more from this part to this part and see how do you measure these particles produced in their interaction, how do you relate what you are going to see here to what you calculate here? And for completeness, I thought before just really starting, one should definitely mention what are the most used variables, standard variables, in all the following discussions. First of all, there is the transverse momentum, which is used all over the place. Here's just a simple definition, transverse with respect to the beam line. This is the polar angle. This is one important variable. The other important variable, both are important because they are invariant under boosts along the beam line. The other variable, which is invariant, is this rapidity. So here's the general definition of rapidity. Now, very often, actually, what the people use is pseudo-rapidity, which you can derive from the rapidity in the massless case here. Then you get this simple relation between the pseudo-rapidity and the polar angle. So in that case, rapidity is basically an angular variable. And for completeness, to get the feeling for the numbers, here are some numbers. So central rapidity, or pseudo-rapidity, meaning rapidity 0 corresponds to a polar angle of 90 degrees. What is interesting, we are going to hear a lot about detectors going up to rapidity of 2.5. Now 2.5, actually, if you look at the numbers here, is something like 170 degrees, which is about 10 degrees. So this 10 degrees might give you another feeling than talking about pseudo-rapidity. And maybe what is more interesting, we will talk about detectors which go up to 5 in rapidity or pseudo-rapidity, and actually this corresponds to a degree to an angle of 1 degree. So 1 degree really means pseudo-rapidity of 5. And then let's start with looking at how do you design a detector. And in fact, you have a lot of ingredients, and we have to go through all these ingredients step by step to see how we arrive at it. First of all, of course, you have to think about what is the physics you are expecting and what is the physics you want to measure. This, of course, will determine your experiment. Then there are the machine parameters, the parameters of the accelerator. These will also have some impact on some of the design aspects. A very important design choice is the magnet system, and I will go a little bit through that because usually I don't think you hear so much about that. Then, of course, there is the tracking, calorimetry. You have to decide which type of calorimetry you put in there. Why do you put calorimetry there after all? Why do you have a immune system after all? And finally, there might be some further design choices or some further things you absolutely want to have in your experiment, which then again impacts your design. I will give an example from CMS, and of course you have to think about the data acquisition system. All of these then determine actually how your final detector will look like. It's also obvious that the single things do not only, let's say, determine the picture in the end, but of course they are all interrelated. Of course, the physics, of course, will have an impact on all of these. Obviously, the choice of the magnet, we will see, can have quite an impact on your tracking or on your calorimetry or your immune system. The machine parameters have quite a lot of impact on the EAQ and so on. So it's all very much interrelated. And my goal here is to give you a few numbers, give you a few ballpark numbers. So the numbers you're going to see, most of them are not up to the ultimate precision, but to give you a feeling for the order of magnitude and to understand why the people are always talking about these certain type of numbers, where do they come from? And I try to give a little bit of understanding of all these numbers here. So let's start with the expected physics. And after all, if you look at proton-proton interactions at the LHC, this is what is going to happen mostly. So the total cross-section of the order of 100 millibonds, so this is very large, you get in about 10% of the cases you have simple elastic scattering. So 10% is quite a lot already. And this is just elastic scattering. In these cases, the protons here will move pretty much forward, so that the deflection in angle will be pretty small. Then there are a few contributions from so-called diffractive scattering. Diffractive scattering means basically that one or both protons stay intact, so they continue to be a proton, but there's production of additional particles. Also in these cases, the proton or both of the protons tend to go pretty much forward. But all this, the diffractive and the elastic scattering, amounts to something like 30%. And all the remaining, the 70% of the total cross-section, is what you can call the non-diffractive inelastic scattering. And this is basically where both protons are destroyed if we use a lot of new particles. This is mostly the interesting physics for us, at least if you do high-PT physics, if you want to do non-diffractive physics, because there are people very much interested in diffractive physics also. But this is basically what we talk about when we also calculate these kind of diagrams. Now, if you are nevertheless interested in diffractive physics, you have to change your basic design parameters from those which I'm going to talk about, which means you will concentrate or you will design detectors which are very, very forward, so far away from the interaction point to cover very, very small angles, not 1 degree, but much less. And these type of detectors are in fact installed also at the LHC, but I will not talk about that. I will talk really about this non-diffractive inelastic part mostly, and mostly about the production of high-PT, large-PT particles. So what is the expected physics? Here are this famous plot of all the cross-sections of the various processes we can expect as a function of the center of mass energy. So here is the cross-section. Here is what you would expect as a rate at very high luminosity. The most important things are the relative orders of magnitude here. Now the total cross-section is here. As we said, it's of the order of 100 millibar, and about 70% of it is inelastic, non-diffractive scattering. And what actually happens most of the time in inelastic proton-proton scattering is both protons are basically destroyed, and you produce a lot of new particles, and I will say what a lot of means, but all these new particles typically have not much of transverse momentum. Typically, they have a rather small transverse momentum in the range of a few hundred MeV, somewhere on average between 500 and 800 MeV. So the transverse momentum will be small, most of them will be going forward. So this is what happens most of the time. And this means basically, if you would have if you take the LHC, proton-proton collisions, you switch on your detector, you open the trigger, and you just look what is coming in. What is coming in is this all the time, just this. You will be standing there and you will just be seeing this. And maybe after some time, sometimes there might be a jet or particle coming out with a little bit more transverse momentum, and then you wait long and long and long, and sometimes there might be a lepton coming out at a PT of maybe 30 or 40 keV. But that's very seldom. This is what is going to happen all the time. And this is why you also call this minimum bias event. Minimum bias in the sense you don't apply any bias in the way you look at what is happening in proton-proton collision. And minimum bias means this is what is coming out. One of the important messages here is that actually the exact cross-section, so the exact rate of this type of inelastic scattering, and the exact amount of the average transverse momentum of these particles and how many particles are produced on average, this is not very well known up to now. We have to extrapolate our models from basically the Develtron up to the LHC energies. So this is quite a large range. And in these extrapolations, there are quite some uncertainties then coming up. So models, as we see also, can be different or can make different predictions up to a factor of 2 or so. So measuring these in the very beginning will be very important. And since this is the thing which is happening all the time, you will get these data immediately. This is the first data you will have on tape, and this is the first thing you will have to do. Look how they compare, what your measurements compare to the predictions, and tune the Monte Carlo simulations then, which of course have these kind of interactions in there. Now, what are the distributions of the particles produced in these inelastic collisions? If you just look at the single particle phase space, it's usually you write as d3p over 2e. You can also write it in terms of the transverse momentum and after rapidity, our two main variables. And if you do that, you basically see, if you just look at the phase space itself, then you would expect basically a flat distribution rapidity. So these particles produced in inelastic collision basically should be rather flat in rapidity, so uniform distribution in rapidity. And here is a plot of a simulation of the distribution of production of number of charged particles per unit rapidity in these kind of soft interactions for two different center of mass energies, 0.9 TeV and 14 TeV. Now, if you look at this range here, then indeed it's relatively flat. It doesn't look so flat, but if you look at the scale here, we talk about somewhere between 5 and 7 particles per unit rapidity. So there's not a lot of variation in a certain region here. Now this dip here actually just comes from the fact that here the people plot pseudorapidity and not rapidity. If you would plot rapidity, it would be pretty flat. And then at some stage it starts to fall off because after all you also have some constraints and then geometric conservation and so on. So you cannot go on forever. But in a large fraction of your phase space, it is indeed pretty flat. And here, just for indication, with these lines you see what part of the rapidity is actually covered by the different experiments. So ALICE, ATLAS, and CMS cover something up to rapidities of 5. LHCb covers only one part of the rapidity and the very forward part only. And then there are special detectors foreseen to be put at very, very large rapidities. Now, you see, most of the particles are produced within something like the rapidities of plus or minus 4 or 5. And then you fall off. So you still, there's a lot of things going on above rapidities of 3 or so. So you better put detectors up to 4 or 5 because you want to collect them. And you want to collect them also to make sure that you collect all the transverse momentum in your event, not to measure fake missing transverse momentum, because you know a missing transverse energy, because probably you know how important that is for searches for new kind of physics. So you see, basically from this distribution, you get the feeling how far should you go in your coverage of the detector, basically. And you get most of the part if you put your detectors up to something like 5. This is where most of the things is happening. Here are the numbers for the particle densities, and these numbers we will use afterwards also. So we can remember, we have about 4 to 6 charged particles per unit rapidity in this range for a region of plus minus 5 in rapidity, and up to 2 or 3 neutral particles. And then they are uniformly distributed in 5. Now, if you know these numbers, of course, afterwards we'll be able to calculate the particle density. But there's another thing I wanted to mention here. I said previously that the average PT of these particles is about 800 MeV, so 500 to 800 MeV or so. And here comes another important thing, which you should keep in mind. So if you have a magnetic field close to an interaction point, let's imagine this is a solenoidal field, so the particles are bent like this or like this. Now you can consider the following thing. Now if you have on average a particle of 800 MeV, and if you, for example, have a tracking system of a radius of length L, now, how big has your tracker to be in order to avoid that all the particles are simply curling up? So if your tracker, if this L would be too large, then basically all the particles with this momentum would never reach outside of the tracker. They would just be curling up. You don't want to have too many curling particles because this just produces a lot of unnecessary hits or deposits in your tracking system. You get a lot of occupancy. And you might be interested maybe to measure a fraction of these particles actually in the calorimeter, not only in the tracker. So how to get the numbers there right? Well, just take the simple formula which relates the momentum of a particle to the magnetic field and the radius, the bending radius. Then you see, if the size of your tracking detector is smaller than this value here, then most of the particles actually will go outside of the tracker. So most of these particles will reach the calorimeter. And if you put in some numbers for a magnetic field of 4 Tesla, you get a length here of about 1 meter. So that is already a number which we find in real life. Our detectors, our tracking detectors at LHC are of the order of a meter, 1.2 meters. And here is one of the reasons for this, roughly. Okay. So if you make them much smaller, this problem would be less dramatic, but then we would not be able to get a good measurement of the bending radius. If the trackers would be much larger, then basically we would have enormous amount of just curling particles in our tracking system. That would not be so good. Next, what comes next? So if you go down, I said most of the time you just have inelastic soft interactions, but from time to time, maybe every 100th event or so, you might have a bunch of particles coming out collimated is a certain PT, let's say above 20, 30, 40 GeV or more. This is where you start to see jet production. And so this is the next thing you're going to do, just because it's the next likely thing to happen. And the interesting part here is that at high energies, the cross sections for jet production here, for example, for producing jets above 250 GeV, they grow very rapidly with the center of mass energy. And that's why at LHC, pretty quickly, we can extend the reach of the Devatron in producing jets with a certain transverse energy pretty quickly. Here is the plot. This is actually for 14 TV compared to the Devatron energy, but it gives you the order of magnitude. This is the jet cross-section for producing jets as a function of the transverse energy. And you see how big the difference in cross-section is and how much more you can extend the reach in transverse energies of the jet. And this is the interesting region, of course, for looking for deviations from QCD, for example, because of compositeness or some other contact interactions. Now, the message here is, since jet production is so important and so happening so often, of course, you want to build detectors with which you are able to measure these jets very well, obviously. And the buzzwords, which we are going to cover in the second part of the lecture much more, will be jet algorithms, jet energy scales, and so on. But from a detector point of view, you want to have detector access with good calorimeters, because with the calorimeters, you're basically going to measure this variable here. And if you measure this variable here with the value, you know where you're sitting on the x-axis. If you don't know where you're sitting on the x-axis, you have a problem in measuring this deeply falling cross-section. I will also discuss this in much more detail. What comes next? Now, if you wait a little bit longer, look at your detector and wait a little bit longer, as I said, sometimes you will start to see photons or electrons with transverse energies or momenta of 20, 30, 40 GeV popping up. But waiting a little bit longer means, if you look at the relative ratios here, you have to maybe wait for every millionth of an event or so, roughly, where you start to see leptons. And where are the leptons coming from? Where is a lepton of 30 GeV coming from if you look at your detector? It must be basically be coming from a W decay or Z decay or some top event. This is where they are coming from. So you start, at this rate, you start to look at your electroweak physics in proton-proton collisions. And again, yeah, the rates, just to compare the numbers. So for a low luminosity, 10 to the 31, this is something we should see rather soon, we have about 1 million inelastic proton-proton reactions per second. And out of these, we have, one W produced every 10 seconds or so. Again, this gives you the relative order of magnitude. And now here comes one important message. And again, one important design criterion for your detectors. If you want to see Ws, or if you want to see Zs, or if you want to see top decay, you better do not look for decays of the Ws and the Zs into jets. Because you have jets all the time there anyway. And you will not be able to see one W decaying to jets out of a million normal QCD jets. That's why you concentrate basically on the leptonic decays of the W or the Zs. And that's why there's so much emphasis put on leptons and photons in the design of your detectors. Simply because otherwise you would just see QCD. You would measure this basically all the time. All the time. There's a little bit of background, some deviation. That's the main reason. And at this stage, once we start to probe the electroweak sector, and even look a little bit more deep in the electroweak sector, if we go back, of course, if you look a little bit more deep in the electroweak sector, where the Higgs sec, for example, the Higgs cross-section starts to come up, then you should look back into history and see what did the people consider as the most relevant processes in fact to study the electroweak sectors. And here are some of those processes which were really the benchmark processes for the people at the time of designing detectors. One was simply proton-proton producing W pairs. Why? This is important because you probably know that if you look at the WW pair production, and you look at the evolution of these cross-sections as a function of the center of mass energy, if you don't have any new contributions of physics like the Higgs at the scale of about the TeV, this cross-section will start to violate linearity. You have a problem there. So something must happen in this process here at energies of the order of the TeV, of the electroweak scale. So that was why this was a very important benchmark process. Now, we said that looking at the jet decays of the Ws is not very meaningful, so basically decided you just look for the leptonic decays, basically, for example, muonic decays. So you already know a very important benchmark process will be two muons, opposite sign, and two neutrinos, meaning a lot of missing energy. So make sure that you have a hermetic detector, you don't lose much, and make sure that you are able to measure muons with an energy of the order of, let's say, 100 GeV or so, the electroweak scale again, all the time. Then in order to discover the Higgs, it was thought the only way to see the Higgs in front of the huge background is via its decay, for example, to two Z bosons, where both decay, again, leptonically, so four muons, or one of the Zs decays to two muons and the other two neutrinos, so this is the same, basically the same final state. But we get the same picture and the same requirements. The other possible decay of the Higgs, which was thought to be visible above the huge background, even if the branching ratio is very small, was just look for Higgs into gamma-gamma, because two photons, pretty distinct, pretty clear signal above the UV background. You just have to make sure that you don't misinterpret jets as photons. If you manage to do that, you might be able to see the Higgs at some stage. Finally, another process for Higgs production is the vector boson fusion, where you produce a Higgs accompanied by two jets. These two jets go pretty much forward. There we know that they are rather in the region of rapidities of 3 or 4. So one reason, again, to put color imagers at pretty large rapidities. Then you have a chance to measure these jets and to detect this kind of Higgs production. And finally, just for looking for anything new, well, a generic new signal would be for the production of a new heavy resonance. Generically, you know that as Z prime, but it could be something else. Just a new generic resonance with a mass of the order of a TeV, which hopefully decays to leptons. So this is another channel, which was a benchmark, basically, which you could see as a benchmark channel. Again, you have to build detectors which are able to measure muons with a transverse momentum of the order of 100 GeV or more. So now you know what you're looking for. And if you look at these cross-sections, at the cross-section for these processes, times the branching ratios, you find out that most of them give you a cross-section times branching ratio of the order of somewhere between 1 and 100 femtobar. And now you know the cross-section. Once you know the cross-section, you know what is the luminosity you will need in order to get the size of the statistic. Okay, this number defines basically also how the accelerator has to run. Now, let me concentrate a little bit more on the production of heavy states. Again, this will influence where you put your precision detectors. Let's take this example of the production of a heavy Z prime. So you produce a state of a large mass M, which is not too far from the center of mass energy in a machine, let's say, of the order of a TeV. This is produced by, let's say, the annihilation of two partons with momentum fractions x1 and x2. Now, let's do a little bit of calculation. So the reduced center of mass energy here, the S hat, has to correspond to the mass of your particle you want to produce here. So this gives you a relation between the center of mass energy in the accelerator and the X values of the partons. Now, if you really want to produce a heavy state, typically both of the partons have to have a similar X value and a rather large X value. Why? If one of the partons has a low X value, so it's soft, you will not have enough energy to produce the heavy state. So typically, they will be pretty large, both of them. So let's make the simple assumption that they are of similar value. Then this gives you the relation, this gives you the amount or the X value which you need in order to produce a state of mass, and then you have a center of mass energy of spirit of mass. Now, the energy of this new particle is simply given by the sum of the energies of the particles, of the partons. The longitudinal momentum of this new state is simply the difference of the momenta, the longitudinal momenta of the two partons. These partons are assumed massless. And now we can compute the rapidity of this new state. Just put in the numbers and you find the exponential of the rapidity is given by the square root of the ratio of the x values. And since we made the assumption that probably the x values have to be both large and both of similar value, then you see that this ratio here will be close to 1 in order to produce it. And then this means that the rapidity will be close to 0. And now we see that typically a heavy Z prime of the mass scale of a TeV has to be produced at central rapidities, meaning at large polar angles. This is where you find it. Otherwise, you will not have enough, let's say, energy momentum. Conservation will not work for you in order to produce it at forward angles. And from this, you can also deduce very easily this relation here, which you will see very often. A relation between the x values of the partons and the rapidity and the mass of a state which is produced. This is very useful. Now, of course, the z decays to leptons. The z prime decays to leptons, and it's only the leptons which we are measuring. So we have to think a little bit what is actually then the rapidity distribution of the leptons. But the decay does not smear out, let's say, this argument too much. If you look here at the simple simulation by Dan Green, I took this plot from Dan Green, then you see that also the leptons from the decay are mostly within a rapidity of 2 or 2.5. And now this tells us, if we want to measure heavy resonances which decay to leptons, put your precision detectors in a region of rapidity of this order of magnitude. So this is where this 2 or 2.5 comes from. There's no need to put high precision detectors at rapidity of 6, because we are not going to mesh to get the interesting leptons out there. They all will be typically in the central region. So this is a very important number for your drawing, for your detector. So here are the first summary of requirements. Detectors, first of all, must identify extremely rare events, and mostly in real time. So you have to identify these leptons over the huge QCD background. So you have to make sure you have detectors in place which are able to measure the leptons very well. And one of the problems, for example, is that the ratio of electrons over jets is of the order of 10 to the minus 5. So which means, out of every 100,000 objects, let's say you have 100,000 jets and then you have one electron, and so on. And now you see, even if you only every 100,000 jets, you mistake as an electron, you have a problem, because then your electron rate will be immediately wrong. So you have to make sure that the mistake rate of jets, the misinterpretation of jets as an electron, for example, is of this order or smaller, of this order. Then the single cross-sections, the really interesting single cross-sections are of the order of up to 10 to the minus 14 of the total cross-section. This has been a pretty new requirement compared to other experiments. And therefore, you need a very, very strong online rejection. Otherwise, with such a rejection factor here, if you want to do this offline, first of all, you would not be able to buy enough disks. Second, you would have to work for centuries, probably, to dig out interesting events if you do it offline. So try to do it online, and you have to store a lot of data, but this will be the topic of the next lecture. Other requirements? Well, you want to measure leptons with high precision, and I will discuss this in a little bit more detail. So you want to have electromagnetic calorimeter for the electrons and the photons. You want to have muon systems for the muons, of course. Good jet reconstruction, I discussed this. Also, good hermeticity of your detector, so that you are sure when you measure missing transverse energy, it really comes from a non-detected particle, and not because you had a lot of, let's say, low-PT particles which just escaped somewhere in the hole. So try to cover with some detectors, some calorimeters you detect even up to rapidity of 5, even if those calorimeters do not necessarily have to be the high precision detectors. Something else which comes in, which I didn't mention so far, is part of the new physics, or interesting new physics, decays to B, quartz, or taus, also top physics, of course, enters here. So if you want to be able to tag B decays or be able to identify tau decays, you better have very high precision tracking detectors in your system. This is what drives then the design of silicon and pixel detectors. Now we come to that. So again, a few numbers for the leptons. So in which range actually do you have to measure leptons pretty precisely? Basically, you have to measure them up from a few GeV to something like a few TeV. Now, the few GeV leptons, they will come mostly from the decays of heavy quarks. And if you want, for example, to be sensitive to heavy quarks, make sure that you are able somehow to measure this kind of decays. So the GeV region is important. Of course, in the middle here is something like 100 GeV or 50 to 100 GeV. This is the range of PT of leptons which come from the W and Z decays, top. And finally, TeV leptons will come from any heavy new resonance. So you have to cover a pretty large range. And with which resolution do you want to cover it? Well, First of all, you would like to measure, for example, the mass of these heavy states, maybe with a precision of the order of a percent or so. If you look to the decays of leptons and photons, if you look at nevertheless at certain hadronic or jet decays of Ws, for example, in the case of top decays, it would be nice to reconstruct dijet invariant masses with a precision of the order of 10%. So if it becomes larger, then it might not be interesting anymore. And why is this? Well, this is simple to explain. Let's take the hypothetical state which decays the two photons. If we plot the invariant mass distribution of the two photons, and you have some background from the standard model which gives you two photons, which falls off pretty rapidly. This is a logarithmic scale, typically. And you have somewhere produced your new heavy state. If you have a pure resolution in your photon energy and then in a photon angle, which induces a pure resolution in the invariant mass, you will smear out basically all your new events over a large region. And then you have to wait quite a lot of time until you start to see significant deviation about this huge background. So better make sure you have a good resolution to somehow to accumulate a clear peak in a rather short time. This is the only basic reason behind all this. And there are some numbers for the particle identification. I don't go too much into detail here. Again, one of the important numbers I mentioned. You would like to have a rejection of fake jets compared to electrons at the level, for example, of 100,000 or better. If you don't achieve this, most of your things which you will call electrons, or many of your things which you will call electrons, actually will not be electrons. Be jets. So, this was the expected physics. What about the machine parameters? Well, one important parameter is the center of mass energy of the accelerator. 14 TeV is the magic number. By now we know that we are going to reach it in steps. Well, maybe the very first energy will be 450 GeV, ejection energy. And now we know that we might run at 7 TeV, raise to 10 TeV, and hopefully at some stage go to 14 TeV. But where are these numbers coming from? Where is the 14 TeV coming from, roughly? Well, first, basically, it is fixed by the radius of the lepton. And what you could do in terms of superconducting magnet technology at the time of starting to design the LHC. The radius of the lepton is fixed. You know then what the bending power of the magnet has to be in order to get 7 TeV protons around it. Then you know which magnetic fields you need, and then you know which type of magnets you need. So you cannot go much beyond the 14 TeV. Now the 14 TeV was considerably lower than what was foreseen for the SLC, which was something like 20 TeV, because they had a much larger ring. So some of the people said, okay, at LHC we will have a much lower center of mass energy, so in order to be competitive, what do we have to do? We have to raise the luminosity. So the luminosity should be at least 10 times the SLC luminosity. So this was one of the, well, basic, some of the arguments. Okay. So the LHC has to be a high luminosity machine. Now, the radio frequency bunch spacing is given by this 25 nanoseconds. This is an important number. On the other hand, we have seen the relevant cross-sections, the really interesting cross-sections, what we're looking for, after all, at the LHC, is in the ballpark of 10 femtobar or 100 femtobar. So. Now, what is the typical running time per year is of the order of 10 to the 7 seconds. Now, if we take a luminosity of 10 to the 34 per centimeter, per centimeter square per second, you can write this also in a different unit. You can say 10 to the 34 corresponds to 10 to the minus 5 inverse femtobar per second. If you take such a luminosity, then you compute that over 1 year, you can accumulate 100 events for a process which has a cross-section of 1 femtobar. But that's where the 10 to the 34 is roughly coming from. If you don't have a 10 to the 34 or this order of magnitude, you will not accumulate a lot of interesting events, and then you are statistically dead. Now we know the luminosity. On the other hand, we have seen what is the total inelastic cross-section. We have seen the total inelastic cross-section is 100 of the order of 100 millibar. If you multiply 100 millibar by this luminosity here, which you also can write as 10 to the 7 inverse millibar per second, then you get immediately, we will have, with this luminosity, you have a rate of inelastic events of 1 gigahertz. So this is the rate, 1 gigahertz. But we have bunch crossings every 25 nanoseconds. So you have an overall rate of 1 gigahertz, and the bunch crossing every 25 nanoseconds, you immediately see that approximately you have 25 simultaneous events per batch processing. This is where this 20 or 25 is coming from. And what are these 20 or 25 events? What type of, well, the most likely thing to happen? What is the most likely thing to happen? Soft interaction. So all these 20 events or 25 events are just soft interactions giving you low PT particles. Sometimes a lepton is there. And now we have seen before what is the density, the particle density in these interactions. We have seen that we have 5 to 6 particles per unit rapidity times the rapidity one to scan as without detectors, it is 2 times, let's say 5 is 10, then you come up with a number of about 2,000. So 2,000 particles per batch crossing. This is at least now you have a problem. 2,000 charged particles per batch crossing, where most of them actually are not very interesting, just produce a problem, which is radiation in your detectors. So you have to worry about radiation levels. Once more about particle densities here, just plot, in fact, what I said before. These are simulations for ATLAS for producing particles at per unit, certain number of particles per unit rapidity. These are two types of simulations. You see the differences are pretty large. And if you go to central rapidities and extrapolate for the center of mass energy, again, you see that the extrapolations can diverge pretty much. So this is one thing we have to measure pretty soon. And also the extrapolation, what is the average transverse momentum at GNSC, must have a certain uncertainty here. Now, if you look at the average transverse momentum, by now we know how many particles we produce, order of 2,000. On average, they have 800 MeV of transverse momentum, which means in every bunch crossing, we produce 1.8 TeV of transverse momentum total. And this shows you why the detector has to be hermetic. In total, you have 1.8 TeV transverse momentum. Even if you miss out a small fraction of those, you can easily generate fake missing energy of a few hundred GeV. Because the overall transverse momentum is quite sizable. So this is one of the challenges. Of course, the other problem now is all these events, there is this what we call pileup, because out of these 20 uninteresting events, you sometimes want to pick out the interesting event and the interesting, for example, leptons. Now, there are two things you can do in order to pick out from this mess an interesting reaction. First, after all, you can use a large magnetic field, because a large magnetic field, nevertheless, will keep most of the low PT particles away, for example, from the muon detectors, which are far out. So you keep your muon detectors clean. And the other thing which helps is have very granular detectors. If you have many cells, the probability that one cell is hit by two particles at the same time, it's just small. And you want that every cell is hit by only one particle in principle. So this is what determines the granularity. And the other problem, of course, is the radiation levels, which are huge. This is a picture of the neutron fluence in ATLAS as a function of the distance from the interaction point. And if you go in the forward directions, you have 10 to a certain 10 to 40 neutrons per centimeter squared per year. And also, you have charged particles, so these deposit energy. The usual unit for energy deposition is gray, so 1 joule per kilo is 1 gray. Or you could see it like this, 1 gray is 3 billion particles per centimeter squared per material of unit density. And now since we have so many particles, 2,000 per crossing every 25 nanoseconds, calculate over a year, you see that the energy deposits are huge. The energy deposit goes up to something like 1 million gray per year per transverse distance squared. And now another important parameter is there. You see that dose falls off like the transverse distance squared. This determines very much how close you can go with your closest detector. If you go too close, but very quickly the dose increases very much. And this is basically one of the reasons why the pixel detectors, the first layers, have to have a certain distance besides, of course, the size of the beamline. On the other hand, we see if you go far away in distance, then the dose falls off pretty quickly. So on the outside, the radiation issues are much less severe than inside. Next, the machine parameters give you a timing challenge in the detectors, because we have these interactions every 25 nanoseconds. Now, in 25 nanoseconds, the particles, even if they travel at the speed of light, they travel 7.5 meters. So you have the first interaction. After 25 nanoseconds, they have traveled 7 meters, they are still in the detector. They are still in the detector. But at this stage, already the next interaction takes place. So you have the particles from the first interactions. After, let's say, 2 × 25 nanoseconds, they are still in the detector, if the detector is large. And you have the second particles in there, and so on. Only maybe sometimes after the third or fourth collisions, the first ones are leaving, start to leave the detectors, and you have all the others still in place. So this means you have to have individual sub-detectors with very precise timing. You have to detect very precisely which particles came from which collision, and you have to synchronize the detectors. If you don't able, you are not able to synchronize the subsystems, you are in a mess. You have no way to say what belongs to what. And you also have to consider that the electronics is 100 meters away, roughly in the other cavern. In 25 nanoseconds, the signal travels 5 meters. So you see, about 20 bunch crossings until your signal has arrived to your electronics. Again, if you don't synchronize, you mess up completely. So your detector's requirements are high granularity, which was pretty new. The fast readout was pretty new. And the radiation hardness was a new problem compared to other experiments, because you want to minimize these problems of the pileup and so on. So many channels. High granularity means many channels. But many channels means money. So you have to find a compromise. Too many channels you cannot afford. Then you had to design a lot of electronics which could cope with this response time of the order of 25 nanoseconds. And in the forward direction, we have seen this enormous neutral fluence. So you have to find materials which can stand this enormous neutral fluence. These are the machine parameters. Next comes the choice of the magnet system. And this actually is a very important design choice. Actually, it's among the most important design choices because, as you will see, it fixes most of the other parameters. Let's take the example of CMS. In fact, in the early days of CMS, the people assumed that actually the backgrounds might just be too harsh to put a tracker in there, because there were no silicon detectors which could stand radiation levels. So there's no way to put that, let's say, a silicon detector in there. So what should we do? Well, let's just concentrate on muonic final states, put the muon spectrometer, a big magnet, put maybe some absorber to get rid of all the rest. That's it. That's one of the first ideas for a compact muon spectrometer. Okay. So in a robust manner, one strong magnetic field to sweep out all the low PT stuff, and only the high PT muons get out. And how do you measure this? Well, the idea was, okay, you have a big magnet, you absorb all the uninteresting stuff in here, then you have 3 or 4 layers of muon chambers where you get several hits. For example, in the first layer, you could get what you call a stop, so a number of hits. And from the direction of these hits and the constraint of the interaction point, you already get a measurement of the bending. You already get an estimate of the muon momentum. If you have further stops, you can get a further estimate of the muon momentum. So that's the simplest way of finding muon. So that was the basic rough idea. And now let me come to another important point is, how do you measure actually the momentum of such a particle, a charged particle in a magnetic field? Typically, you don't measure it from the radius, from the bending radius. The bending radius can be pretty large. What you know is, typically you know the size of your tracking system, which is this one. The particle starts here, spans, and comes here, for example, from here to here, or from here to here. So this is the size of your tracking system. This we know. So another way to measure the momentum is by measuring this deviation of the path from the straight line. This is called the sagitta. And the momentum is inversely proportional to the sagitta. So what we can try to measure is exactly this parameter here. This is what is typically measured. And now we can look, what is the relative momentum resolution if you take this formula? We see the relative momentum resolution is equal to the relative sagitta resolution. So you will measure the momentum as precisely as you are able to measure the deviation of the path from a straight line. The other important thing is this parameter here, L square B. So the relative momentum resolution is inversely proportional to L square B. So what do we know now? Either you have a spectrometer which is very large, L should be large, and the magnetic field should be large. Then you get a good momentum resolution. Now, L getting too large is again a problem, because then you have to go to your funding agency and say, I have unfortunately designed a pretty large detector, costs a lot. So there's a compromise to be found there. Try to increase the magnetic field as much as possible, maybe. Now you can choose. You can either choose a solenoidal field, like here, so you have the interaction point, you have a solenoidal field, and then you have somehow to bring the field lines back. There's one problem now. The bending power, so how much basically the momentum changes during the flight across the magnetic field, really depends on the integral of BdL of the path perpendicular to the B field. So if the particle flies most of the time parallel to the B field, there's no bending power. The particle will not, the momentum will not change, which means particles which go very forward, they stay most of the time parallel to the field lines, so the momentum direction is not changed. The momentum direction is only changed if they fly orthogonally to the field lines. So a solenoid is good to bend particles which go out like this, but it's not good for particles which go to large rapidities. How can we measure well particles which go to large rapidities? Well, just change completely the magnetic field configuration. Instead of having the field lines going like this, produce magnets which have the field lines going around the detector in closed loops. And if you do this, you have a closed loop in the barrel part, and you can also put similar coils in the forward part, and you have just the field lines going around like this. Because now, the particles going forward, they will see basically an orthogonal magnetic field all the time. So they are bent very much, and you can measure the momentum pretty well also at very large forward angle. If you build such a large toroid system, then you also get very easily a large BL square. And another interesting thing is, if you have the magnetic fields completely confined in these loops here, you keep the inner part of the detector completely free of magnetic field. So your calorimeters will be free of magnetic field, whereas here, on the solenoid, these parts here of the detector, they will be sitting in the magnetic field. So if you put something here, like a calorimeter, it will sit in a magnetic field. Of course, if these things become too large, they become expensive. And here's a drawing from the early times of Atlas, where they had to decide how many coils actually do we put here, how many of these toroids should we put in there. And you see that you would like to have many of them. Why? If you put many of them in this type, in this picture here, it's 12, your field will become more and more uniform, and you would like to have a uniform field. Why? Otherwise, your tracking is just very complicated. You have to know in every point of space what is the field. If it's uniform, you just know it. If you reduce the number of coils, it gets more and more messy. Again, the funding agency is your enemy here, and they had to reduce to 8 coils, because otherwise it would not just be affordable. So here's the option, solenoid versus toroid. The solenoid, you have this simple field configuration, so one basically magnetic system. You have basically to install also a return flux, basically put a lot of iron out here to keep the field lines close to the detector, otherwise you have the field all over the place, all over the cavern. Particles will be bent on the inside in this way and the outside in the other way around. So this is basically a simple design. It's just one big magnet. The part which drives the cost is basically the size of this magnet. What is the radius of this coil? And at that time, something like 3 meters was doable and payable, 3 meter coil. And with 3 meter and the superconducting solenoid, you can then build a magnet which can produce something like 4 Tesla. 3.5 Tesla would still deliver pretty good physics, and our standard value today is 3.8 Tesla. Of course, as I said, you better build a return yoke to keep your magnetic field lines in here. Now you can instrument your return yoke with muon chambers, then have everything in there compact. But if you put a lot of iron, you have a problem, because the particles, the muons, have to go through the iron. They're not very much disturbed, but they are disturbed. So it will have multiple scattering. And I will discuss later on that multiple scattering will limit your resolution in the end. Will put an absolute limit on the resolution. And I will show also that these kind of things, this kind of magnetic field configuration, could impose a problem in understanding exactly the stray field in your cavern. The other problem is, as we saw, the tracking in the forward direction is pretty limited in precision. So actually, one should write here, limited in precision. And one important problem here. There comes one important number for CMS. If we can build a magnet of 3 meters, and then outside we build the muon system, and inside we have seen we would like to have a tracker of something like 1 meter. Now we have 1 meter or 1.2 meters of tracker, we have 3 meters of radius of the magnet. We want to put the calorimeters inside the magnet, so we have 2 meters, so less left for the calorimeters. So you have to build calorimeters as small. And you see afterwards that this is a problem. The other option is toroids. But if you choose toroids, actually you better put another magnetic system in there, because you still would like to put tracking around the interaction point. This you cannot do with a toroid. There's no magnetic field in the interaction point. So you put a smaller solenoid close to the interaction point. Now the toroids are huge, they determine very much the cost, the overall cost of your experiment. And the problem I've mentioned, you have to know pretty well the field map. This is complicated. But you don't need a return yoke. You don't need iron. The field is just in this closed loop around the detector. No iron means much less multiple scattering for your muons, which is good if you want to measure standalone muons. And you can measure muons also at very high rates, pretty well. And now you have a lot of space for your calorimeters. The toroids are out there somewhere far away. Then there's the inner solenoid, so there's a lot of space for putting calorimeters. And we will see that this is good for good calorimeter. And Atlas people in the beginning said, still there's a lot of physics happening in forward rapidities, so let's put a system which measures particles well at large rapidities. So the other problem now is, if you have a solenoid inside, a small solenoid inside, and the toroids outside, the calorimeters will sit outside the small solenoid, which means electrons, photons, they will have to go through the coil of the solenoid. That is not good for the calorimeter, because then, of course, the particles will lose part of the energy in the coil. But there's no other way around this problem. So this is a disadvantage. So here, just for reference, I took this from the paper of Frodo and Svikas. Just a few numbers, and you can look at the details of the numbers afterwards. One important thing is that the currents are huge, and the energy stored in these magnets are huge. And all these magnets have reached the currents, the design currents. This was really a major technical milestone. So maybe as the last part for today, I go to tracking. So what are the basic tracking requirements? Well, you want to reconstruct efficiently and precisely all charged particles from something like a GeV up to, let's say, many hundreds of GeV, or even up to a TeV, up to a rapidity of 2.5. This is where you want to have precision tracking. Then you might be even wanting to trigger on certain particles like electrons. You would like to reconstruct secondary vertices. And you would like to match, for example, tracks in the tracking system to the calorimeter, or to clusters in your calorimeter. This is important for electron identification, to separate your electrons from pions and so on. And pretty good tracking systems might even allow you to look for hadronic tau decays. So the tau decays to very thin jets, somehow jets with very few particles. And now you have a conflict of interest. The conflict of interest is robust tracking means you would like to have many layers giving you many hits per track, because even if the track loses a few hits, you still have enough to find the track. Many layers means a lot of channels, which means a lot of electronics. Electronic, which is fast, which means a lot of power. A power means heat. Heat means cooling. Cooling means pipes. And pipes means dead material. So you have cables, pipes, support, and so on. A lot of dead material. Not good. Instead of a tracker, you end up with a calorimeter. And this is the conflict of interest. And it has to be solved, not probably in the best way, but this is what you have today. Again, let's come back to the momentum resolution. We have seen this formula before. Now let's get a few numbers again. Take a tracker of 1 meter radius, a magnetic field of 4 Tesla, and you have a particle of 100 GeV. And you would like to measure the particle of 100 GeV, the momentum, this 100 GeV, you would like to measure with 1% precision. Put the numbers in this formula, you will find that you have to measure the sagitta with an absolute precision of the order of a 50 micron. So you have to have something, a measurement of the 50 microns. Now, if you determine the sagitta from individual hits, it's clear that also the individual hits have to be measured at this order of precision. So this gives you this order of magnitude for the precision of your tracking detectors, for your pixel detectors, your strip detectors. Because if this is 100 micrometer, you will never reach 1% here, full stop, that's it. Now you have to design a tractor which on the one hand side gives you a very large single hit resolution. This is, for example, determined by the pitch, by the distance in the strips, but you cannot make it too small also because you get too many of them. Again, material. The length of the strip should not be too long, because if it's too long, the probability grows that two particles hit the same strip at the same time. This is occupancy, you want to keep the occupancy low, and so on. So you have to optimize all these parameters. Now, here is the basic layout. If you have to design a tractor, start with this picture. You have the beam pipe. Well, this is not to scale. This would be a pretty bad beam pipe, I would say, compared to the rest. It's a little bit smaller, but doesn't matter. Then, after a few centimeters, you would like to put the first layer as close as possible. Not closer. So this is as close as possible, but not closer, which is mostly given by the size of the beam pipe and by this 1 over RT square of the radiation dose. So you can go to something like 4 to 5 centimeters. This is what the Atlas and CMS detectors did. So you have a few layers, three layers at the moment, between 4 centimeters and 12 centimeters of pixel detectors. Three-dimensional hit points. Afterwards, it would get, of course, it opens up. It would get more and more expensive to put all pixels here. So you switch over to silicon strip detectors up to a distance of about 50 centimeters. Now, these silicon strip detectors have rather fine pitch, so you get still a pretty good single hit resolution here, but not three-dimensional anymore. But actually, our tractor is 1 meter long, so we have to cover another half a meter. We cannot go on, again, just with small, very fine strips. Why? Because we need something cheaper, because the area goes like R square. That determines the cost. Again, your funding agency, it's your enemy. But also the material, of course. Not everything is the fault of the funding agency. And so you have options. Either you go to coarser pitches, so the larger strip distances, or you could put in gas use detectors. In fact, in the beginning, CMS was planning to put in MSGCs. So these are gaseous detectors. Or you go to, for example, straw tubes like Atlas. This is a gaseous detector. And this can even be combined with transition radiation technology. And this is what was chosen. Now, CMS chose, well, they have a three-layer pixel detectors close by. Then you have a tracking detector with pretty fine pitch, up to 50 centimeters. And then you have, again, silicon strip detectors, but with coarser pitch outside. There's another reason for coarser pitch. There's no need to have a very precise pixels here, because when the particle reaches out here, it will have already a certain multiple scattering. So there's no point of measuring with a precision which is much better than actually the physical uncertainty of the position here. Atlas also has a pretty huge pixel detector. Then you have strip detectors with similar parameters here. And outside, they opted for a gaseous detector, the structures. One important point to mention, maybe you're not realizing this, the tracker of CMS is shorter than the solenoid. What does this mean? It means that the tracker of CMS sees basically a homogeneous magnetic field all over its length, and only far away the field lines start to bend. The Atlas tracker is slightly longer than the solenoid, which means that the outer parts of the Atlas tracker see a magnetic field which is not homogeneous anymore. So, of course, this makes tracking more complicated, and it's not so good for obtaining high precision at the large angles. And the other big issue is material. So this is the material budget in terms of radiation length of the two detectors. And this is an unfortunate similarity of the two detectors. So they go up to more than one radiation length in this region of rapidity. Now, why does this peak exactly here? This is the transition from the barrel to the forward part. Somewhere you have to get out the cables, for example. This is the angle where you get them out, typically. And if you look at it, actually the sensitive track detectors themselves contribute only a little bit. It's mostly the uninteresting part. It's mostly cooling, support, electronics, cabling, which contributes to this material. And one very sad number is that the material from the first designs, where the people sold their trackers, to what we have now, is that increased by 2 or 2.5. Or the weight increased from 2 to 4 tons. That's a lot. And what does it mean? It means that the electrons having to go through this detector they think they are going through a bishop, which means they lose up to half of their energy before reaching the electromagnetic colorimeter. So they shower. You have to recover all these photons somehow. And the other thing is, the photons which go through this tracker also think they are going through a colorimeter. So a large fraction, half of them or more, actually just convert. So if you want to measure photons, you should also be able to reconstruct the conversions. So this is a bad thing of the Atlas and TMS trackers. Again, for reference, here the numbers, the ballpark numbers, reconstruction efficiency is of the order of 80 to 90%. So the probability to find the track of a certain few GeV is 80 to 90%, and the momentum resolution is for 100 GeV. Particle in CMS is in fact close to the 1% I was asking for previously. So in terms just of performance for central tracks, the performance of CMS is definitely better because intrinsically the tracker is designed for that. At the large rapidities, the difference is not so huge. And again, some tables just for reference. Here, you just find all the parameters of these tracking systems. And I think now I have to stop, and we can go on to the other design criteria tomorrow. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Gilbert. We have time for one or two questions.
You said that by reducing the energy from 12 or 14 keV to 7 keV, some people are saying that you can compensate by increasing the luminosity.
Well, you see that the cross sections, they grow with energy. So if you go to lower energy, your cross sections decrease. So in order to get still the same number of events, you have to increase the luminosity. That's it, basically. You understand?
But our detectors are for 14 dB, or they can also make it good with 7 dB.
No, I think they're pretty well designed also for 7 TV. That's not such an issue, I would say. And when I say that we have to go to higher luminosities because we're so smaller center of mass energy, I was more talking about 14 TV of the original LHC design compared to the SSC design, which was even much further. And the SSC luminosity was not as high, so the LHC people said, let's push the luminosity very much. But this is just, let's say, this is just 25 basically inelastic proton-proton scattering. Now, in there you can have multiple pattern interactions too, so this gives an additional multiplicity, let's say. But this probably is a noise, well, a little contribution to the overall number of particles.